This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Mark Mix. He is president of the National Right to Work Committee and National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation. And we are going to talk about the impact of labor unions in the economy and the real estate market and society in general today. So I think this will be a fantastic conversation. Mark, welcome.
Jason, good to be on with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Where are you located?
We are located just outside the Beltway in Springfield, Virginia. We can blame everything on those people inside the Beltway back here in Washington, D.C. And yep. Look to the West for economic opportunity and freedom.
There you go. So maybe not everybody understands that in some states, believe it or not, in this modern era, you are literally forced to join a union if you want a job. You don't have a choice. You don't have a right to work. Explain what I guess there are 27 right to work states in the country where you don't have to join a union, but elaborate on what that means, a right to work or not a right to work.
Yeah, Jason, it's a really simple concept. Unfortunately, going back to 1935 in our country, the United States Congress under Roosevelt and the New Deal decided that they were going to federalize labor policy, and they were going to bring labor management relations back to Washington, create a government board that would adjudicate disputes and use Congress to impose rules and regulations and statutes on the American workforce. Well, from 1935, when they did this, they basically said that you could be forced to join a labor organization as a condition of getting or keeping a job in America. And that was kind of a novel concept. In fact, they had tried it back in 1933, and the Supreme Court ruled this type of industrial policy was a violation of the Constitution. But Roosevelt, in his wisdom, decided to threaten the court, pack the court with six additional justices. And believe it or not, in 1937, this new Wagner Act, Labor Policy Act for the country, was ruled constitutional. And from 1937 to 1946, the union movement grew dramatically, of course, because this is really an unbelievable privilege. In 1947, the new Congress came in and passed what is then known as the Taft-Hartley Act, which allowed states, if they could, by voluntary and affirmative action, to pass what are now known as right-to-work laws, meaning they could get out from underneath the compulsory unionism aspects of the national labor policy. So from 1947 to today, workers in 27 states have the ability to choose whether or not to financially support a labor union. Interestingly enough, Jason, from 1935 till a Supreme Court decision in 1963, you could actually be forced to join a private organization. Today, you can't be forced to join, but you can be forced to pay up to 100% of dues or fees. So it's a very interesting, novel concept, and that power has been a unique power for labor unions in the country. And just in the last 8 years, we passed five new right-to-work laws in states where heretofore people would have thought, gosh, you can't do that in a state like Michigan or Wisconsin, which we have. And the law is extremely simple. You have the ability to choose whether or not to financially support a labor union, and you can't be fired if you don't.
Okay, so and we may disagree on this. I don't know, but let's just stay back in history. And then, of course, we'll bring this to the modern era. But I think that in the beginning, labor unions really did have a place. I think they were needed. I think in the big industrial era of the Carnegies and the Rockefellers and the Mellons, you know, employees were pretty weak and it seems to me, at least in looking at history, like they did need to form unions to equalize the level of the playing field a little more. Now, today, sadly, I think that unions are completely overrated and unnecessary in so many ways. Workers have so many rights now. You know, it's, do you even need a union anymore? And especially, my God, public employee unions. That is literally the most illogical thing I've ever seen. But what do you think about that? Now that I'll get off my soapbox.
No, Jason, I agree with you. And you're right. There was a place for labor unions in the American workplace. There is a place for labor unions in the American workplace. And there will be a place and should be a place for unions in the American workplace. The fact of the matter is, if you're an employer and you're not taking care of your employees and you're doing things that are, antithetical to basic, behavior when it comes to your employees, you should get a union, and workers should be able to join together voluntarily to amplify their voice. What there's no place for in American labor policy is compulsion. There should never be any law that says you must be involved in this organization, you must pay money to this organization, and you must fall under or be pushed into this union collective if you say no or don't want to be part of it. That's the problem with labor policy. It's not the idea of unions per se in the private sector. Now, as we unpack what you said up on your soapbox, I agree with you. In the public sector, it's an entirely different animal. We should never stand in the way of teachers joining associations, whether they be unions or not. But the question is, do you recognize that private organization to negotiate working conditions when you have taxpayers and elected officials and you put this third party group in between them? I agree with you, and so did Franklin Roosevelt, that was something that was unthinkable. You wouldn't unionize government in the same way that you would unionize private sector workforces, because by definition, government does necessary services that can't be provided from other sources. And I know that's more ideological than it is realistic at this point, because government's involved in everything. But the notion that we can apply this confrontational labor model that developed in the private sector to the public sector, I agree with you 100% on that. We should not recognize unions for purposes of bargaining with government employees.
Okay, so yeah, because and the reason the public employee unions are such a wacky idea is that the government is the arbiter of fairness. And yet you should be able to, you're basically unionizing against your fellow taxpayers. That is craziness. That is absolute craziness. Yeah. But in a private company, if you want to join a union because you think the union offers you benefits as a worker, sure, you should be able to join it. I mean, it shouldn't be illegal to form a union, but it should be illegal to force somebody to join a union if they want a job. That is absolutely anathema to free market anything. That's just completely unfair. It's like you have to pay this many times corrupt organization that has just taken your money and spending it in all kinds of abusive ways that we've seen, and that's, been exposed many times, just because you want a job. Why can't you just have a job without, maybe you don't want to be part of that, right?
Yeah, it sounds really simple. It really does. And it really is very simple in that regard. And this idea of individual freedom, the kind of the fundamental bedrock of who we are as a nation and our constitutional privileges and our First Amendment rights, you can't have the right to associate if you don't have a corresponding right not to associate. I mean, these are simple issues, but because of politics, to your point, Jason, this is big business and it's big money, and union officials use their power in significant ways in the political system. And, you talk about the corruption and these workers still forced to pay union officials. Right now, there's a scandal unfolding that is really kind of bigger than most scandals we've seen in organized labor, and that's the United Auto Workers Union. They've had two of their past presidents, their most immediate past president, had to resign because his house was raided by the FBI. The previous president's house was raided by the FBI. 12 UAW officials have either pleaded guilty or been indicted on racketeering and kind of extortion and criminal charges. I mean, that's what the federal prosecutor called it, racketeering and extortion. They're starting to use those words in the context of this scandal. But yet workers in states that don't have right to work laws are still required to pay fees to that union to keep their jobs. That is wrong.
Yeah, it definitely is. Okay, let's talk about the impact on the real estate markets of right-to-work areas. I don't want to say states, because like when you talk about real estate, a state is too big, right? You got to talk a little more micro than that. And then the broader economic impact. You tell us what you think about that first, and then I've got maybe some specific questions, largely about Detroit, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm glad to talk about that. Let me talk about it in the context of states, right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states.
Sure.
We can kind of maybe get more granular with your questioning. But the number of people employed is almost double the growth, the percentage growth rate of number of people employed in a right-to-work state from 2008 to 2018 is double that of forced unionism states.
Okay, say that again.
Yeah, the percentage growth in the number of people employed from 2008 to 2018 was double in right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states. So that's the percentage growth in people employed. The growth in manufacturing, private sector payroll employment, was double in right-to-work states between 2013 and 2018 than forced unionism states. The percentage growth in total private sector non-farm employment was basically about 1.5% greater, 17.2% in the right-to-work states, 13% in the non-right-to-work states from 2008 to 2018. And one thing that goes specifically to the real estate market, new privately owned single unit housing authorizations per 1,000 residents in fiscal year 2018, double in the right to work states versus forced unionism states. So the growth in manufacturing and private sector employment are occurring in states that have right to work laws now. And really, you don't have to use statistics to see it. You can see, for example, the automotive industry moving for, well, they don't have to move from Michigan anymore because Michigan's a right to work state. But you look at, you know, where the foreign
manufacturers. But mostly it wasn't. That only changed recently, three years ago. Maybe in Michigan?
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Right. Yeah. And so you look at BMW and Mercedes-Benz and Nissan.
They're setting up in the South and all the right-to-work areas, right? Yeah. Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. And if you go to Nashville, Tennessee, and you go to, you know, South Carolina produces more automobile tires than anybody in the whole world now. And they produce aircraft down in South Carolina. And, you know, you see where the growth centers are going. You know, the unions want to blame it. They say, well, it's because, you know, air conditioning. We've got air conditioning now, so people can move to Florida and move to South Carolina and move to Georgia and Alabama. Yes. And that's just not true. I mean, employers are going where they have, where employees and employers can have a relationship with each other. It's not necessarily interfered with. Now, are there unions in those right-to-work states? Absolutely, there are unions in those states. But workers get to hold union officials accountable because they can vote with their pocketbook.
Right.
Whereas in a state California.
As it should be, absolutely, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah,
in California, in the Socialist Republic of California, my old home state, thankfully I don't live there anymore, but there you don't have the right to a job, right?
Right. You don't have a right to work without paying union dues or fees. That is correct.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So,
and that's a,
go ahead.
No surprise. I guess you're in Arizona now. Is that right?
I used to be. I'm in Florida now.
Okay.
You know, so
okay.
I just keep lowering my tax rate with every move. Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this situation now. They have unions in right-to-work states that where you're not required to join a union. So let's talk a little bit about that culture and how it works. For example, you mentioned the car manufacturers that have set up shop in all the hot real estate markets in the southeastern United States, and we've done tons of business in all those places for many, many years. And I agree with you. That's where the growth is. It's in those right to work states. But what happens when you apply for a job at, you know, BMW, for example? Are you presented with, there is a union here in this shop, but you don't have to join it? Is that how it works? Or give us a little idea as to how that works.
Yeah, actually, none of the automotive manufacturers in the right-to-work states in the South are unionized. They've tried. They've tried twice at the Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga. They've tried at the Nissan plant in Mississippi, and they failed because the workers there, they like the relationship they have with their employees in most cases. They like their benefits and their pay packages. And so there's no need for a third party to come in there and get in between the workers and, you know, their supervisors and the management of those companies. So, but let's say, for example, you go to a place where, let's take a right-to-work state first, and you go to a place where there is a union, okay? Mm-hmm. What happens under federal law, and this is something that union officials desire and try to maintain at all costs, is they get to be the exclusive bargaining agent for every worker in that particular shop. So they're the single voice. They're the only ones that can talk to the employer. and they're the only ones that can start the grievance process or finish the grievance process if you have a problem. They control every single worker, whether that worker is a member of the union, whether they're paying dues or not, in a state that has a right to work law. In a state that doesn't have a right to work, you would be in a right to work state, they can be forced into this collective, but they can't be forced to pay for it. In a non-right to work state, you're forced into this collective and the union says, you know, we'll negotiate everything for you and we'll do all this stuff for you, but you have to pay to keep your job. And so this is one of the reasons why employers, you know, site selection experts, consultants, CEOs of companies looking to invest or put a new plan up, we know now. And this is evidence that's come out more and more so in the last, you know, maybe 10 years, basically 3/4 of everyone looking to expand or relocate or invest in a manufacturing facility or an additional facility for their company look at only right to work states. So that means that basically, if you're not a right to work state, 75% of all the economic opportunities that may present themselves out there in the marketplace won't even consider your state,
right? Because they'll just pass you by right there. Now, what about Amazon? I mean, we all know Jeff Bezos is a liberal, and so, you know, he probably loves unions. But what about Amazon, for example? They've been searching for new campuses, and they're, you know, they're already in a pretty liberal state. What's their scoop?
Yeah, well, you look at the two places where they've actually decided they're siting, Tennessee and Virginia, both right-to-work states. They had announced that decision to site a new facility in New York City or outside of New York City, and all of a sudden, the union started posturing, saying, okay, you're going to be unionized, we're going to unionize this, you got to we demand that you have neutrality agreements, you let the unions in. And what did Amazon do? They said, you know what, we're not as interested in coming to New York anymore, and they stopped that particular development. I think they maybe still be doing smaller things there. But generally, what Bezos and Amazon are looking for, and where they've cited their new expansion, I forget what they called it. What did they call it? Amazon 2 or whatever, something.
Yeah, right.
And it ended up in Tennessee and Virginia, both right-to-work states.
Interesting. So even they didn't want the bits. And if, you know, it's so interesting how at the end of the day, you know, people say a lot of stuff, but they always vote with their pocketbook. You know, it's like, or they vote with their feet, if you will. Same idea, right? They just go where it's more beneficial to them. And we look at all these big tech companies sprouting all their leftist ideas, yet they've got companies set up in Ireland and the Netherlands to, you know, do the double Irish twist so they don't have to pay any taxes in, you know, in the jurisdiction where they're really operating. I mean, they're just hypocrite scum. I can't stand it. You know, Apple even, you know, and I like Apple, right? They were sucking taxes out of California, right? By setting up another company in Nevada, I think. So they didn't have to pay California tax. And it's just ridiculous, you know, do what I say, not what I do, right? That's the mantra.
Yeah, that is interesting. But, we do know that the labor policy certainly has an impact on those types of decisions as well. And just to your point, I mean, one of the things that I think is the most effective argument about right to work is that, you know, union officials take away the incentive for them to come and organize workers in a right to work state because there's no guaranteed revenue stream. Mm-hmm. They can't force people to pay dues. They can try to convince you. They can sell you a product. They can say, we'll do these things for you. And if they follow through on it, just like any small business person, you know, if the bakery shop, if you're the only bakery shop in town, you don't care how good your rolls and muffins are.
Yeah.
But if
how high your prices are.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But if there's five bakery shops, it's a totally different calculation. And so what right to work laws do very simply is they give power back to the worker instead of the power to the union official.
Exactly.
And that's really the secret of it.
Exactly. They give the worker the right to make the decision in a much freer type of marketplace as it should be. Okay. So where do we go from here? There's 27 right to work states in the country. What is the direction of this? I assume it's for more right to work states. Is there anybody coming on board soon to give the workers the right to work without being forced to join a union?
Well, it's manifest destiny, Jason. You know, the idea that we hope is someday that no worker anywhere in the country can be compelled to pay fees or dues to a union to keep their jobs. We have an ongoing state program. We have programs up in Minnesota and New Hampshire. We have a program in Montana and Colorado and a few states where we think there's a probability that we can pass right to work laws, and we continue to do that. We also have a bill in the United States Congress. It's a one-page bill. It doesn't add a single word to federal federal law. It simply says that the authorization of forced unionism, it was created back in 1935 in that Roosevelt-era New Deal, that we're repealing that and we're making the bias in federal law in favor of voluntarism. We have, I think, 23, 24 co-sponsors of that bill in the Senate. We have 100-plus in the House. Again, doesn't add a single word to federal law. It simply repeals provisions authorizing union officials to have workers fired. So we have a congressional, we have a U.S. Congress program, we have a state program, and we also have a litigation program. In fact, on June 27th of 2018, our attorneys argued a case called Janus v. AFSCME, which ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court. It came out of Illinois. And in that case, we won. The majority of the Supreme Court agreed that no government employee anywhere in the country can be forced to pay fees to work for the government. That is a national right to work law for all public employees across the entire nation. So that was a huge step forward when it comes to government sector unionism, this idea that you can be forced to pay fees to a private organization, a union, to work for your government was just a bridge too far for the U.S. Supreme Court. And they ruled that that was a violation of workers' First Amendment rights, and the state was in there compelling this violation, and so therefore they can't do it anymore. So that was a huge victory. That type of victory in the private sector is probably not as easy from a litigation standpoint, because the courts tend to try to stay out of as much as – well, I say this. Ideally, they try to stay out of private sector labor relations and private sector contractual relations to the degree that they're legal and there's consideration and there's a meeting of the minds, or, you know, those elements of contract. So we continue to push on the legislative front. We continue to push on the litigation front. And the movement's getting stronger and stronger all the time, because people recognize now the importance of the issue, not only from an economic standpoint, but from an individual freedom standpoint. I think those two points, the individual freedom being the most important, you know, predicated on who we are as a country and our First Amendment protections, but also on the economic side, it can't be argued anymore. You know, union officials say, well, you make more money in forced unionism states. And yeah, I guess if the cost of living is, you know, two times the cost of living in a right to work state, you can argue that a plumber in New York City makes $95 an hour as right. a union member, and a plumber in Provo, Utah only makes $65. And you can say that's a $30 union difference.
Right. Well, but first of all, a bunch of that goes to the cost of living, which would be automatically adjusted in any market. And a bunch of it goes to the dang union. That's why they have to be paid more, because they got to pay their union dues. How much are union dues generally? How much do they cost?
Yeah, no, that's a great question, and it depends on the occupation, but we now have come up with a fairly reliable average between $800 and $1,000. Now, if you're an airline pilot, it can be as
what?
High as $2,000 or $3,000.
Per what?
Per year. Per year. Right. Per year. Yep. $1,000 per year for if you're a teacher, or, you know, you're a machinist, between $800 and $1,000. If you're an NFL football player, it can be a whole lot more than that. can be hundreds of thousands, I suspect. I don't know that for sure. We ended up representing some football players back in the strike. I think it would have been 1995.
Basically, let's look at the teacher example. If you're a teacher, now that's a public employee union, okay?
Yeah.
So it may not be the best example, and I don't know in which direction it would or wouldn't be. But, you know, if you make $50,000, that's 2% of your income is going to the union.
Yeah.
I mean, they better be doing something for you, or you're getting just completely ripped off.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly right. And if they're doing something for you, then have at it. Give them more money if they're doing good things for you.
Right.
But if they're not, and the only claim they have is you have to pay them money because you want to work at a particular school district, which they can't do anymore under the Janus decision,
right.
which is great news. But but take that example and move it over into the private sector, and you still have that scenario unfolding with workers in 23 states.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the Janus decision again that you mentioned a few minutes ago. I mean, isn't it beautiful, our legal system and court system, just by going through litigation, you can literally change the law of the land. That is an absolutely beautiful thing. You know what? In what other country can you do that? You know, that's incredible. I mean, it's like having your own political power, your own lobbyist, and hopefully the decision that's adjudicated is fair and good. It's certainly not always. Many times it goes the other way, but just the idea that you can impact government in that way and literally change the law by litigating a case is an absolutely wonderful right, you know?
Yeah, well, it's you're absolutely right. And, you know, it's funny. I wrote my daughter and I was taking my daughter to work or to school, driving her to school. And I was on my way down to the U.S. Supreme Court because we were arguing another case there on behalf of some teachers and public employees from the state of California. And we had that conversation. And the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation has argued in front of the U.S. Supreme Court 18 times. And this Janus decision was one guy in one bargaining unit in Illinois having the courage to stand up, allowing us to represent him. We went all the way through the court system, the federal court system. We end up at the steps of the United States Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And on the very last case decided on June 27, 2018, of the whole term, we waited outside 3 days for them to have to hand down this decision. And sure enough, we win that case. And one man, Mark Janus, with our help and the Legal Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, was able to change the law for every single government employee in the country. That is remarkable.
Mark Janus is like the United States modern version of Lech Walesa in Poland. Okay. And I've been to the Lech Walesa Museum twice now in, why can't I think of the name of the city, but it starts with a G, Gdansk. Thank you. And, you know, it's really incredible. Yeah. That's the way we do things here. You do it through the legal system and it's great. Give out your website and tell people where they can find out more or support your organization or whatever.
Yeah. They can find us on that wonderful World Wide Web at www.nrtw.org. That's our Legal Defense Foundation. Our committee, which does the legislation, is nrtwc.org. And in those two places, you can find out lots of information about the right to work. If you live in a right to work state, you can have any of your kind of frequently asked questions or simple questions answered there. We have an 800 number. We have 21 lawyers who provide legal representation to employees and information to employees, and they do that for free. And so it's a great place to go and kind of get a feel for what right to work means and the impact it has not only on individuals, but on our country as well.
Real estate investors, remember, when you're evaluating a real estate deal, if it's a right-to-work state, it's probably also a landlord-friendly state, and it's a state where people are moving to. It's a state that is growing most likely. This is almost always true, by the way. Just look at the 27 states, and, you know, by and large, what I say is the way it is, you know. So you're going to have a better investment experience, and there may be a mitigating factor that makes your deal better in a, you know, in a no right to work state, right? But by and large, you're just going to do better in right to work states. So think about that when you're buying your next piece of property. Mark Mix, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jason. Thanks for the opportunity. It's great to have a conversation with you about this issue.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, HartmanMedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own. And if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.